This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Here we go. Who's going to take this shot to try to tie or win? Outside to Bogey. He's crowded. Three. Oh!
Bogdanovich! At the horn wins in Houston.
Bogdanovich!
Yeah. That sucked.
Boy, so, what a way to start off the week.
Yeah, sorry to anybody just waking up or driving in. That's some weird dude screaming, Bogdanovich.
Yeah.
Is probably not the way you wanted to wake up.
No. So we will cleanse you right now. Well, not completely, because we're going to talk about that Rockets game last night. But welcome in, everybody. Nice to be back in the saddle again. Seth and I were gone the last few days of last week. Big thanks to Wade Smith and Cecil Shorts for filling in.
I was excited that they got to have 3 days together.
Yeah.
So just form some chemistry. Jonesy, did they treat you well?
They were perfect gentlemen.
They were okay.
They were gentle with you? They were gentle yet strong.
Yeah.
They didn't get handsy with you, fellas.
Jonesy? Okay, good. Yeah, I heard good things. I saw good things on social media about Wade Smith and Cecil Shorts. So we thank them for filling in for us. We are back. Sean Pendergast and Seth Payne with you on a Monday following a buzzer beater that the Rockets lost last night at Toyota Center, and it's always much worse when it's the Utah Jazz on the end of something like that. I have a hard time getting hatred built up, Seth, for professional sports teams. It's just I'm older now. I love my teams, but as far as like hating professional teams, it's hard because players cycle in and out. You're really hating the jersey as much as anything else.
You're a New York Yankee, and you want to hate every Astro, and yet Gerrit Cole is now your Yankee.
Yeah. But I have no problem working up a sufficient amount of hatred for the Utah Jazz, which is what made last night all the more painful.
So
the Jazz I still hate.
Mostly because
of their fans.
It's hard to let go of that hatred for the Jazz. It's understandable. I think that, especially given this experiment that's going on, I guess people are still struggling with the nicknames. Some don't like Micro Rockets. I like Pocket Rockets, but I suppose there's kind of a little... So the double entendre thing going there, kind of like there was with the tea party where people were talking about other forms of tea thinging.
Right.
You call them the Pocket Rockets, and there's a whole bunch of other jokes that go along with it. But yeah. The micro ball is fascinating, and it's one that I think that this performance versus the Jazz, in some respects to me, is as exciting as the victory over the Lakers, just because... It's a good performance versus a really, really good basketball team. This one versus the Jazz, you end up losing on one of four buzzer beaters that have been completed in this first half of the NBA season.
The entire season.
The entire season, there have been four buzzer beaters. Two of them have been against the Rockets.
Yeah.
And that's
Jalinka and then this dude, Bogdanovich.
And Bogdanovich also has two of those four buzzer beaters.
Right.
There's a whole 6 degrees of separation going on there that I don't know, but I don't like it. I don't know exactly what the significance is.
I don't know that they could have defended that much better last night. The last play, I mean, it was one of those ones where he's fading away with two guys on him. You know what I mean? Like, that you let him catch it, maybe, I guess, is an issue if you want to get worked up about that. The Rockets led for...
6.9% chance of that ball going in, according to computer people.
So what are you going to do? Now, the Rockets led for most of the first three quarters of this game, and the Jazz are a good team. They crept back into the game. I thought the Rockets showed some moxie towards the end of the game. They were down by 7 with 3 or 4 minutes to go in the game, and they came back, not only tied the game, they took the lead in the game. But P.J. Tucker pointed this out. He said, it was a buzzer-beating shot, but that wasn't what lost the game for them.
That last shot didn't lose the game. He lost the game way earlier in the third quarter, again in the fourth. They scored way too easy. Jordan Clarkson got whatever he wanted. Mike Conley got to the rim. Whenever you win it, we gave up wide open threes, so I can go down the list.
Yeah. Rockets center, P.J. Tucker.
No need no stinking centers. You know what's crazy is when we went away on vacation, we lived in a world in which most teams would have a center on their team.
Yeah.
The Rockets, we come back to the NBA where they do technically, they've got big men, they just choose not to use them.
That's right.
Even when Russell Westbrook is unavailable as he was Friday night.
That's right.
And you were at that game in Phoenix.
I was at the game in L.A. and the game in Phoenix.
So you saw the glory of microball in L.A., but then you saw the downside of it when Russell Westbrook is out versus Phoenix.
Yeah, that the Phoenix game on Friday. Look, let's look at it this way, Seth. We are now three games into the post-trade deadline version of the Rockets.
Yeah.
I know they were playing small ball before the trade deadline, but they traded Clint Capella for Robert Covington, essentially. I know there was more involved, but that in terms of the Rockets' rotation, that was the deal. So we're really now into the first three games of they are all in on this whole thing. Yeah. And Covington was able to make it to L.A. out there to play in that game and hit two gigantic three-pointers at the end of that game. If I'm assessing the Rockets these first three games of the post-trade deadline, the full commitment to the pocket Rockets, as you like to call them, I would say I'm completely enthused by what happened in Los Angeles. Mm. I would say the Phoenix game is a bit of a throwaway for me because Westbrook wasn't playing. A lot of reason they're playing this style of ball is to maximize Russell Westbrook. He wasn't even on the floor in that Phoenix game. Kelly Oubre is just shooting. He was like the love child of Larry Bird and Steph Curry. In that game, they were waving the white flag in the third quarter. That game, to me, the Phoenix game, while disturbing in some respects, is not a game that I look at and go, okay, well, this really forecasts doom and gloom for the Rockets. And to your point, last night's game, you lose on a three-pointer to one of the best teams in the league.
And no Eric Gordon, too. And
no Eric Gordon.
Not
also,
that you ever, you're not making excuses. These are regular season basketball games. I feel like a lot of people were acting like beating the Lakers was the David versus Goliath or something. I think it was one regular season game. It wasn't anything that necessarily surprised me. I thought that they were capable of doing that. Mm-hmm. The biggest question and the one that will remain until the playoffs is, okay, what exactly happens versus teams in the playoffs when they can get a beat on you, get a rhythm on you? But there's some things that teams just simply aren't going to be able to do well versus the Rockets, including last night. Your biggest question is, okay, hey, well, what are you going to do when you go against a team that has a big like Gobert? Well, at times, Gobert wasn't a factor at the rim because the Jazz put Gobert on Russell Westbrook. So Russell Westbrook, as he stated after the game, was not afraid of going after Gobert.
Well, I go right through his chest and put the in the basket. Same way I would do anybody else. He ain't no different. He just happened to be a little taller. They all same, you know, ain't no different than me.
I haven't seen such aggressive anti-French sentiment since the early days of post 9/11. This is when we were calling them freedom fries, and Russell Westbrook's got no respect for the French.
I'm going to tell you right now, and I've been saying this somewhat subtly throughout the year because I've been, you know, kind of checking myself here, but I'll just say it right now. Rooting for Russell Westbrook is one of the most surprising, like the joy I get in rooting for Russell Westbrook might be the most surprising thing of my adult fandom. How much joy I get in rooting for him. He was one of my least favorite players in the league when he was on Oklahoma City.
Yeah.
He's one of my favorite athletes right now.
Remember how dirty you felt for the multiple years that you had to talk yourself into Dwight Howard?
Yes.
It feels the exact opposite of that. It's come so easy. Dwight Howard, it was constantly like I was having an inner monologue, or like, all right, Seth, come on, you got to do this. He's a Rocket now. You got to actually like him. No, all those other things that people say about him are wrong and uninformed. And I was constantly doing it the whole time he was here. Now I don't have to do that with Russ.
Let me tell you something about Dwight Howard.
Yeah.
As we mentioned, I was at the game in L.A. on Thursday, and we stuck around after the game. It was cool, man. We got to hang out on the court after the game. Dwight pulled a Deshaun Watson after the game. He was out there working on his game after the Rockets, after the loss to the Rockets. Now, he was out there shooting 18-foot elbow jumpers. I don't know that they're going to bring him in necessarily off the bench to do that. But for whatever reason, Dwight Howard decided to work on his 18-foot elbow jumpers after the game on Thursday.
Gasol reborn, huh?
Yeah, I guess. He was shooting threes before the game, like during warm-ups.
Yeah,
like,
he did that here a lot. That was always one of the stories in the offseason.
Doesn't feel like a great use of your time.
Yeah, but he's a different guy now. He's found himself. He's given up a little bit of he's killed his ego a little
bit. He does. He's got the Zen working.
Yeah.
All right, so the Rockets small ball experiment. It's not an experiment. This is what they're committed to now for the rest of the year. They lose last night to the Jazz on a buzzer beater at Toyota Center. We'll talk more about that as we roll on a Monday. Seth and I are back. Nice to be back. Is it still a reaction Monday, Jonesy, or is it just a Monday? Because the XFL played yesterday. Mm. Are we reacting? Because Seth and I are about to react to the Roughnecks win over the hated Los Angeles Wildcats. Take that, L.A. We beat you in basketball on Thursday, and then in football, professional football, on Saturday.
And there were cameras and mics all over the place.
Thus, it was professional football. I liked it. It was pretty good.
No, I'm saying it was above board. Yeah. There was no cheating.
Oh, no. There was,
if there was, it would have been caught by one of 400,000 microphones on
true,
the field.
True.
Walker, whip time, takes the shot. Cam Phillips, caught. Touchdown, Roughnecks.
How about that? The June Jones run and shoot, baby. The Houston Roughnecks, they're 1-0. They're undefeated in their history. Seth, the Houston Roughnecks are on pace to win every game that they ever play in. That's what they're on pace to do.
They're on pace to run the ball about 17 times this season.
I'm down.
I'm all for it.
That is not a team that's trying to establish the run.
There is a revolution going on in Houston right now, and it is led by two dudes who are both 70 years old. The small ball revolution, or continuing revolution, I suppose, led by Mike D'Antoni.
Right.
And then June Jones doing the same thing he's been doing since he first started it back in the 70s with the run and shoot right here in Houston.
Yeah, what's old is new.
It's just that you're flat out just doing the same damn thing again.
What did you think?
I thought it was a pretty good product. I think that's the biggest thing. Compared to the first XFL, which was all about, hey, our cheerleaders are strippers, and hey, it's going to be as violent as possible, and hey, we're not even going to put guys' names on the back of their jersey. We're going to have he hate me. The first XFL 20 years ago was all about gimmickry. This was actually about football, and I think a lot of people were pleasantly surprised at, I think, the quality of play. I think I don't know if star is the right word, but you've got an intriguing quarterback, and that I think people can get behind.
You mean?
Yeah, with the Roughnecks.
Yeah, PJ Walker.
Yeah, and I think that the quality, the overall level of play was pretty good. I think the XFL did a good job of doing the training camp thing, where they had that extended camp here, and they had multiple scrimmages and everything.
Yeah.
It didn't look like these guys were all just learning the plays. So the actual football was good. And then I think the biggest point of conversation for a lot of people was just all the cool things they were doing on the broadcast.
Yeah, what did you like best about the little wrinkles in the broadcast?
I liked the coaches and players being mic'd up. I thought that was really cool.
Where you could hear the plays being sent in and stuff like that?
Yeah, well, and I think especially just the conversations between coaches and players. I don't know if I'm a fan of actually hearing the actual play being called in by the offensive coordinator.
Well, and especially because then what would happen is in the Roughnecks game, for example, Joel Klatt would try to predict with a telestrator while the game is going on, oh, so this guy is probably going to be doing this right here. You know what I mean? And I'm like, I don't know if I like knowing that ahead of time.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because the call doesn't mean, the actual hearing of the call, like, I don't know when he's like, you know, when June Jones is like, you know, spider fly red 18, like, okay, it's just a bunch of jargon to me. But obviously these guys have been kind of either have been picking up what some of the play calls are during the game. I'm talking about Joel Klatt, or they get it in production meetings and things like that.
Well, and it's just some of it's kind of standard nomenclature for whichever system of offense you're using, so guys can figure that out. But it doesn't always work out that way. There was one play where Norm Chow was saying, okay, now look for the guy over the middle. Which is interesting to me. I did like hearing that part of it, because he's not talking about specific receivers or
right.
Anything.
He's
just and frankly, I don't know if all these guys know each other yet. So because they haven't, Norm Chow might not actually know who was lined
calling
up in
them
the
by
slot.
Numbers. Yeah.
So it was exactly that. He said, "Okay, look for the guy in the middle," and I liked that because it ended up. And then they did the telestrator, and they could show how gunked up everything was in the middle. The defense that was called was very good, and the quarterback had to kind of drift out. Now that I might be talking myself back into that. That's never going to happen in the NFL.
Right.
Like, there's no way coaches and teams are ever going to be cool with hearing the offensive.
Can you imagine O'Brien having his play calls broadcast on the game? Like, CBS, they have a mic on him, and he's sending in plays, and people are able to hear nomenclature and everything?
Well, and what if some other team had employed the dark arts that the Astros intern had instituted last year?
That's right.
There's a big Wall Street Journal article on Friday. Yeah, so
we'll get to it.
So we'll get to that. But, yeah, that part, they were doing it in real time.
Yeah.
But you could actually – you could hear the call on the TV – I think the XFL itself might have to change that a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a pretty easy leap to think like, oh, you mean we could actually have somebody watching the TV and hear the actual offensive play call?
Yeah, I think that one, you're right. They may need to address that, because that could affect the competitive, you know, that could affect the competitive fabric of the game. The one thing I know that they did that the NFL will never, ever, ever do is where you get to watch, the AAF did this too, so I'll give them credit, even though they're defunct now. Is where you get to watch the replay official kind of talk his way into what the call should be.
Yeah.
They will never do that in the NFL. And I think it was awesome to watch. I would love to hear it in NFL games, but they'll never do that.
Well, there was a really cool play in the Roughnecks game where a defensive back laid the wood on a dude in the end zone. It was a really nice hit. And the officials reviewed it to see whether it was an illegal launching or helmet to helmet, whatever they're calling it in the XFL. And that was you got to watch the replay official go through it, and you could see in real time it looked like it was going to be an illegal hit.
Yeah,
the kid did an awesome job of just laying his shoulder in and hitting on the shoulder pads. And yeah, you get to watch the whole what the replay official is looking at, the conversations he's having with other people. That part was really cool. I think that it got. Was it 17,000 for the XFL?
Yes.
And it seemed like most of the games were around 17,000 to 20,000 around the league.
Yes.
I think they're happy with that. The TV ratings were 3.3 million viewers for the first game, which beat what the AAF did last year. The AAF dropped off a lot after that, but the AAF also went off to be... They were broadcasting on, I don't know, like CW and stuff after that. It wasn't... They weren't broadcasting on Fox and NBC.
Sports Network.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
The XFL will continue to be broadcast on the major networks.
Yeah, and that strikes on what I think, to me, was the biggest thing that was a validator for this league, at least in week one. We'll see what the ratings are. To me, they're going to get really good ratings in week one because of the curiosity factor. The same way the first XFL did 20 years ago. Had huge ratings in week one, and then by the end of the year, barely anybody's watching. This is more sustainable, obviously. It's a better product. It's a better presentation. It's a better brand of football. To me, the biggest thing specific to the Roughnecks game on Saturday, Seth, was I'm watching the game on TV. Kurt Minifee is the play-by-play guy. That's the Fox studio guy during the NFL season. Joel Klatt is the color commentator. He's the color analyst. He's their number one guy on college football. Brock Huard is the sideline reporter, very recognizable guy. Dean Blandino is part of the team, very recognizable guy. The announcers were big feel announcers, and so it gave a bigger feel to the game.
I know a lot of people, and I felt this way too, and so did Brandy, they felt that the sideline reporters interviewing players all the time was a bit intrusive, that it was just too much, that it was all the time guys coming off, and it just didn't, it felt, maybe we'll get used to that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think in the first game on Saturday, they were really heavy with it. They interviewed the kicker after he missed a kick, which was pretty cool, and then they interviewed him after a big one later on.
Yeah.
But I don't, it just, I again, maybe I have to get used to that, but it felt like it was a bit much.
If they're going to do that, they need to, they need to have their sideline reporters embrace that character, which struck me as somebody who is very annoying at parties that just walks up and starts talking to you. So he needs to start everything with, hey, buddy.
Hey, guys. Hey, buddy. Or right in the middle of as the quarterback's talking to his coach. Hey, what you guys talking about?
Putting his arms around,
do that.
Arms around both of them.
What you talking about, guys?
Standing in between them like flounder.
Mike and Cy Fair says, I can imagine Bill calling a run on 1st and 10 and 2nd and 9 and everyone in the building knowing about it. You can't have these guys mic'd
up. That's true.
Can't hear what they're calling.
Well, Brian might not need to be mic'd up.
It's 2nd and 10 after an incomplete pass. Let's listen in to see what Bill O'Brien's going to call.
Right,
we know what he's going to
call. Well, we know O'Brien might have lost the FCC license by now for the XFL if he were mic'd up.
I thought that, obviously, I think the players and... Oh, what do we have?
No. Okay. I'm just...
Obviously, the players and coaches, I'm guessing, had been instructed to watch their language, because I think on Saturday there was only one F-bomb that made it through.
Yeah.
When you've got that many mics on the field, like usually in any NFL game, there's more than one F-bomb that makes it through. So I would say kudos to the players for managing your language for the most part.
You know, it happened on my watch, and I'm not proud of that. I'll never be proud of it. I didn't like it, but I have to own it, because in a leadership position, I mean, the commissioner's office made it very, very clear the GM and the manager were in position to make sure that nothing like this happened, and we fell short.
That was AJ Hinch on the MLB Network on Friday in a fairly lengthy sit down with Tom Verducci. I thought A.J. Hinch did pretty well on Friday, Seth. All things considered, I thought he acquitted himself pretty well. They made it pretty clear on the broadcast, because they treated this thing on MLB Network like it was 2020. It was a special report, and they had Robert Flores in the studio with Tom Verducci setting up the interview itself, because they recorded the interview, I believe, on Thursday, and they ran it on Friday. They then had all sorts of breakdowns on the interview, Twitter reaction, things like that, reaction from other analysts on there. I thought overall, and the reason I bring that up is because they made it very clear that no questions were off limits with A.J. Hinch. If you know, I don't know what to believe or not believe.
I think that they, well, Yeah, I believe that. Okay. I'm surprised at some of the questions Verducci didn't ask.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think he necessarily, they didn't ask. This is interesting. When it's on MLB Network, I found it interesting that Verducci didn't ask any questions about whether the Astros thought other teams were doing it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So when you're doing this big, not an expose, but you're trying to keep everything transparent, and you're doing it on the network, but you're also doing it on a Friday news dump afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
The interview came out at, what, 5 Eastern?
Yes.
5 Eastern. So you're dumping this and yet having this big transparent interview, and they didn't ask about any other teams. I found that kind of surprising.
That's a good point. So A.J. Hinch, to me, we're going to sprinkle in parts of this interview throughout the show today, but to me, the part that is, if you know, we have about 20 cuts from this interview on a sheet, and so you and I look at it before the show, and we run our eyes down this thing, and we look at, okay, what is the money quote? What's the high point of this? And you and I both sort of looked at it on our own, and then I think agreed that the part where A.J. Hinch explains smashing the monitors as his way to send the message to the players. There's so much to unpack from just that, because it was clear that A.J. Hinch didn't want to confront the players directly about
right.
it, which I think speaks to leadership issues he admittedly was having back then. He wasn't nearly as comfortable in his own skin as the manager back in 2017 before winning a World Series as he is now, or was in 2019 last season when he was the manager for the team. A.J. Hinch was asked point blank on why he chose to smash up the monitors as his message to the team, and why he didn't just stop the garbage can banging.
You're the manager. You're in the dugout. You have to be hearing the banging going on, correct?
Yeah, no, I heard it. I heard it. I don't think you process it right away. It's like you hear a lot of things, but I heard it.
So at some point, though, you begin to process what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, obviously, you know it was wrong. The question is, why don't you step in at that point and say, guys, knock it off.
I wish I would have. I really do. I think that's a big question that I'm going to process over what's now a season-long suspension. I think it's something that I've continued to think about, you know, certainly through the investigation and when you have to openly talk about it. I wish I would have done more. Right is right and wrong is wrong, and we were wrong.
I wonder how much responsibility A.J. Hinch feels, Seth, about the what for some folks maybe is a ruination
mm-hmm.
of the 2017 World Series. You know, I think there's a lot of fans that feel it's tainted. I know there's a lot of fans that are voicing their displeasure with it by not buying season tickets now, I would imagine. I'm as excited as for a baseball season as I've been in a long, long time, but people process things in a different way. I'm sure A.J. Hinch, the part of him is thinking about himself, going, boy, I can't believe I put myself in this spot, but I do wonder how much A.J. Hinch looks at this thing and go, I'm the one guy who could have stepped in and stopped this thing, and then nobody's talking about this 2017 World Series as a ruined, tainted World Series.
Well, and he kind of mentions in this interview a couple times, and this is something that a couple former managers have talked about with the dynamic between a manager in baseball and the locker room, the clubhouse. It's not as simple as, hey, I'm going to tell you what to do, and then there you have it. And I think that a couple times in the interview, A.J. Hinch mentioned that he's a different guy in 2019 than he was in 2017. Mm-hmm. In 2017, A.J. Hinch was still very much proving himself as a manager for the Astros. They'd had some success, obviously, but they hadn't won a World Series. And Carlos Beltran had been brought in to be the veteran leader on that team, to bring a leadership that they didn't have in 2016. Right?
That's exactly right.
And Carlos Beltran was one of the lead dudes in this scheme. So, and I'm not excusing A.J. Hinch, but I think it was pretty clear from this interview that he felt like it wasn't as simple as him going in and saying, hey, Beltran and everybody else, stop doing this.
Yeah, let's,
I don't think, yeah.
Well, I was going to say, let's play that out just for a second here. What do you think happens? So let's pretend for a second, I don't know, we don't have to role play the thing, but let's pretend for a second that A.J. Hinch confronts the team about that. What do you think is the worst case scenario?
Well, the worst case scenario is that they say, screw you, or Beltran especially says, screw you, or they say, okay, we'll stop, and then Beltran goes around and kind of undermines A.J. Hinch's effort. Because remember, A.J. Hinch is only 3 years older than Carlos Beltran.
Mm-hmm.
Carlos Beltran, as A.J. Hinch and anybody else would tell you, is a far superior player to A.J. Hinch. So Beltran, who you brought in to be your leader, that Beltran was brought in specifically to help tell young guys what to do and how to act like a pro.
Putting him next to certain guys' lockers right. So that they could get that rub off of
so
him.
So is Hinch going to go in and contradict what the guy you brought in to be the veteran leader is? And yeah, and then what happens if this younger guy, who the players are going to respect, the players are going to respect Beltran a hell of a lot more as a former player than Hinch as a former player. And, you know, and that's not an insult to Hinch. I mean, that's just obvious. Beltran's a better player. That what happens if it doesn't work out? I think that to me explains why he smashed the monitor. And he never came out and explicitly said that I was afraid that they wouldn't listen to me. But he hinted at it a couple times.
Yeah, here is Hinch on smashing up the monitors and why that was his way to try to send the message to the players that he didn't like the sign stealing.
I didn't initiate or I didn't endorse it, but I was the manager. And I think there's a responsibility when you're in a position to end it. I think my mindset at that point was to demonstrate that I didn't like it.
So what did you do?
I hit it. I mean, I just, a bat. I mean, I didn't like it.
You took a bat to it.
Yeah, I didn't like it. In hindsight, I would have had a meeting. I should have had a meeting and addressed it face forward and really ended it. You know, leadership to me is often about what you preach. It's like your pillars of what you believe in. Leadership is also about what you tolerate. And I tolerated too much. And that outlash of angst that I wanted people to know that I didn't like it. I should have done more. I should have addressed it more directly. I mean, it's complicated when you're talking about a team and all the inner workings of a team, but in reality, I just feel like I could have done more.
And that's where, and it was Phil Garner that we had talked to that mentioned about how complicated it is.
Yes.
That was the word that AJ Hinch just used. It's complicated with the inner workings of a team. Then you find out from this Wall Street Journal article on Friday also, or was that Saturday? I can't remember anymore. Yeah. The front office may have been more involved. Luno, at least, had been informed of it via email. Whether he read the emails is unclear. So between the front office being involved in this and Carlos Beltran being involved in it, it's not as simple in Major League Baseball as coming into the clubhouse and saying, well, this is the law and I'm laying it down. And I'm not excusing Hinch for it. There's still what he should have done, but it adds a little bit more depth to exactly what was going on.
Yeah, you get a sense for how difficult a spot he was in this whole thing. And keep in mind, he had not won a World Series at this point.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of stuff gets conflated in this because it's being adjudicated in 2020 and all this stuff happened back in 2016 and 2017. It really literally does go back to 2016 now because that's when the front office came up with this codebreaker spreadsheet that you just alluded to, Seth, this Wall Street Journal article that talks about some of the folks in the front office essentially coming up with a spreadsheet to decipher signs based on film work that they'd been doing. So it's not an easy situation that A.J. Hinch was put in right there. A.J. Hinch smashing the monitors was his message to the players. He didn't address it directly. And the players went on to say, and this was reported. Did you want to hit something before?
No, this is the audio.
Yeah, the players went on to say in the investigation, when they met with the investigation team for Rob Manfred, the commissioner of baseball, that if A.J. Hinch had told them to stop, they would have stopped. Here was A.J. Hinch's reaction to that.
That the players stated that if manager A.J. Hinch told them to stop engaging in the conduct, they would have immediately stopped. Do you believe that to be true?
That's hard to hear. I hope so. No, I hope so. You know, I hope that as in a manager position,
hitting the monitor with a bat wasn't enough.
Clearly, it wasn't. And I think that's what I look back at as something I could have done better. I think as you grow in confidence, right, as you grow as a manager, if you look at my career, I'm much much more confident today than I was in 2017. Where I fell short is I didn't believe that at the time. Otherwise, I probably would have handled it differently, and I should have.
There were a couple of parts of the report that rang hollow for me initially, and a couple of things that were done kind of awkwardly in the report where it felt like it was more politics than report than actual investigation. One of them was that little sentence where it said the players said they would have stopped if they'd been told to. That immediately I put myself in the position of a player being questioned and somebody saying, would you have stopped if the manager had told you to? Yeah. Like, what are you going to do? Like, admit to something? Yeah, otherwise, You would say, if you say no, it's like you're admitting to a crime that never occurred, but you're claiming responsibility for it. You're like stacking on a checker of what you've already done. So, of course, the players are going to say, oh, sure, yeah, I would have been, I would have been a model citizen if only somebody had told me that I would stop. I don't think it's as clear as that. Right. I don't think it's as simple as that. You got a whole league full of players saying, oh, I never would do that. Look, if you were in that situation on that team in that moment, chances are there's a really good chance that the peer pressure was just at the peer pressure obviously was at a point, and the culture was such that nobody was being a whistleblower until 2 years later.
Yeah.
I think Hinch kind of got screwed over with that little bit in the report.
Yeah.
That, the players say that they would have. What part of an investigation is that? The players say that they would have done something if given this opportunity. So we're going to stack that on top of what A.J. Hinch did wrong.
Where they don't have to go back in time and prove that they actually would have done it.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Like, would you
you know what I mean?
What would I have done in various historical situations?
Yeah,
let me make myself
the right thing?
Look better for having done the right thing.
Yeah, that was...
Let me tell you what I would have done if I were Nixon. Yeah, right. Everything would have been a whole lot different.
Exactly, exactly. We're talking about the A.J. Hinch interview on Friday on the MLB Network. He was asked about Mike Fiers and what his feelings were or are about his former pitcher, Mike Fiers. Here's what A.J. Hinch had to say.
I haven't spent a lot of time focusing on the emotional side of the reaction to Mike, you know, telling this story and getting this message out. I wish I would have had an environment and a culture that was better for him to have come to me in real time. And I wish I could have done better to maybe get that nudge that maybe I needed help to get that nudge to make better leadership decisions. So I focus on that. I understand there's going to be people on both sides of the argument on what should have happened or what could have happened. But my relationship, I haven't talked to Mike since 2018, 2019, every time you play somebody. But I'm focused on how I could have had a better environment for this to be, you know, directed towards me earlier.
I think A.J. Hinch in that quote, Seth, is beating himself up. Man, he's not beating himself up. He sounds like he is, but he's beating himself up over an environment that would be impossible to create. It would be impossible to create an environment, a baseball clubhouse environment, where a player feels like they can go rat out the rest of the guys on the team.
But I wonder, though, too. Because it wouldn't necessarily be ratting out. It would
or maybe
be,
just expressing his feelings.
Right.
Yeah, that's true, because A.J. Hinch knows it's going on.
Right.
Yeah.
So is Dusty Baker, and that's a big question, right? Okay, you hire a guy that, in a lot of ways, you look at this as, wow, okay, we need the perception and hopefully the reality to be that, okay, Dusty Baker never would have let this happen. Perhaps with Dusty Baker, whose emotional intelligence is off the charts in terms of how he manages the locker room and everything, would he have handled this differently? Would he have gotten it all out in the open? I think A.J. Hinch is saying that. I think that this was one of the parts of the interview where he very clearly was taking responsibility. He's showing contrition. He's doing all the right things. I would say throughout the entire interview, I never felt or heard him say, and you know what? At one point, I kind of thought maybe this is a good thing and it's going to help us win.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, so he never admitted it. And maybe he never felt that way. He expressed displeasure with it. But I think back to when steroids were prevalent in football, when steroids were prevalent in baseball, coaches knew that it was going on. But at the same time, what do you do if you're winning? And you know your guys are breaking the rules and you're not involved with it directly. But wow, we're winning a lot of games. At one point, there's some small part of you likely that thinks, well, I don't feel good about this, but wow, we got a good thing going. Well, and do I want to mess with that?
Well, let's you know, if you play that forward for a second, if you you and I are spending a lot of time in this segment going back in time and wondering, okay, if this, you know, if he had confronted the team, then what? And when we're trying to get into our heads and figure out what would be happening here, if indeed they had stopped doing that, and let's pretend for a second that they go into this swoon in September. Let's pretend he does it after the memo comes out, right?
Yeah.
It's the middle of September. It's September 15th, 2017. And this is when the rubber is meeting the road with the sign stealing.
Which, by the way, the real unfortunate part of all this is that this is when it pretty much stopped working amongst the good teams, at least, because other teams were onto the Astros by then.
Yeah, Farquhar had sniffed it out, the pitcher from the White Sox, 6 days after the memo.
Everybody was switching their signs every six pitches. It was nuts.
Right,
yeah.
But they kept doing it.
Yeah.
And so let's pretend for a second that they stop doing it, and all of a sudden the team goes into some sort of hitting slump, and they get knocked out in the divisional round or the ALCS, whatever. They don't win the World Series. Can you imagine what the feelings for the the feelings the players would have for AJ Hinch if, even if that's not the reason why,
right,
it just so happens to line up with a timeline where the players feel like it was a reason why they didn't go on to win the World Series, there would be huge resentment in that clubhouse for him going forward, maybe forever, as his time as manager.
Right, and that might have been it for him. So there was a bit of, and I don't want to rake him over the coals for this. I feel like Hinch, he's the one of the first guys that's gotten out there and been really, really open about it and pretty much honest about it. But I don't know if he held back or if he didn't. But at some point along the way there was a little bit of self-preservation in not allowing this. I think he hinted at it.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's what he means when he's talking about how he didn't have the confidence at that time. Part of it was just like, yeah, he didn't. Exactly what you said. They hadn't won a World Series yet.
Right.
It wasn't so clear that this was going to be he was going to be the guy for the Astros moving forward for a long time.
Yeah.
So, and allowing it to happen and maybe compartmentalizing a little bit and just you stop thinking about it. You're like, all right, I don't control this. I'm just going to keep managing. That he was also benefiting from that. Well, at least in theory, right? There's all these advanced stats people and everything trying to figure out whether it was actually helpful or not, and nobody can really figure it out.
Yeah.
If you know what it feels like? It feels like nutritional supplements, where athletes will take stuff that they're not sure if it's working, but they want to take it, and the advertising is really good. So you either placebo effect your way into it working.
Say, it might be a placebo.
Right. So I think that, so when people say, why would they keep doing it if it stopped being effective?
Yeah.
There's a little bit of like, why do people keep taking so many supplements when only a few of them are actually effective?
It's psychological.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's psychological. We're talking about the AJ Hinch interview on MLB Network on Friday. We'll sprinkle in other parts of it. There's so many layers to this interview about not just Hinch's future, but the Astros, Hinch's thoughts on his answer about the sign stealing in New York is maybe the most uncomfortable part of the interview. We'll get into that in the 7 o'clock hour. Meanwhile, Seth, the opponent of the Astros in 2017, the Dodgers, finally completed their big trade for Mookie Betts.
Yeah, this is a long ordeal. This spanned the entirety of our vacation.
It did. Yeah, it was a long ordeal, as you just said. They finally got it done yesterday. David Price and Mookie Betts on their way to the Dodgers. And there were a lot of people breaking down the baseball effect of all this. You know, Mookie Betts, MVP a year ago, and he's going to be in this Dodger lineup now. The Red Sox, of all teams, kind of doing a salary dump. You know, they're one of the three or four highest payrolls every year, and now the Red Sox are in this avoidance of luxury tax mode, like a mid-market team, so I'm sure Red Sox fans are up in arms about that. My first thought when I saw Mookie Betts going to the Dodgers was to think of these Dodger fans who have been so sanctimonious about this whole sign-stealing thing throughout this whole revelation of it over the last several months. Dodger players saying that they should award the World Series to them in 2017 and 2018. The LA City Council putting a proposition together where they feel Rob Manfred should give them those two World Series.
That's well-spent tax dollars. Right
Good
job spending time on that, LA City Council.
Yeah, well, that's, I guess
sure
that's why
your citizens are enthused.
I guess that's why you got to charge 13% income tax out in California. These clowns that are driving down the 405 to go boo the Astros at a game against the Angels, all this stuff. Mookie Betts was on the 2018 Red Sox Dodger fan, so I just want to know, how does this work? Do you just welcome him in now with open arms? He was one of the cheaters that wronged you in 2018 when the Red Sox beat you for the World Series, so is he your guy now, or do you shun him? How does that all work?
I think if there's one thing that's become very clear, it's that the Red Sox aren't going to get nearly as much hatred for this, because one, they didn't win the World Series. They won in 2018.
Yeah, they did.
For some reason, I mean, because we don't have nearly as many details about the Red Sox and
yet the results are coming out soon,
right? So we'll see. But I don't know. I wonder. In some ways, it feels like it's going to be the afterthought in a lot of ways.
Maybe
it's going to be the Nagasaki to the Hiroshima. It's going to be it's not going to loom as large because the Astros have already been designated the villain. And that's how people would perceive them.
Yeah. Yeah. Should be an interesting season for the Astros. The pitchers and catchers report pretty soon. We're gonna start to hear from more of the players, I would imagine, on this whole thing. I'm trying to think, who did I hear speak out about it? It was Charlie Morton.
Right, Charlie Morton.
Yeah.
Charlie Morton, did he apologize?
I don't know.
He's sounded like he did the Charlie Morton thing where nobody in the world's going to be angry at Charlie Morton. Nobody with the Rays is going to all of a sudden, you know, be angry at Charlie Morton for stealing any of their chances. And he's Charlie Morton. He didn't piss anybody off when he was saying it.
Yeah, no, he doesn't need to apologize to us for anything. Charlie Morton, you're good. You are still on the no pay for drink list here in Houston for a long, long time. All right. AJ Hinch, I think will work. Do you think he's going to work again, Seth?
I think he did a pretty good job in that interview of the PR spiel of everything that he's supposed to say and how he would change things the next time around. I think there's a good chance he does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he's going to work soon. I think he could work as soon as 2021, to be honest with you.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.